This is 1A. I'm John Donvan in for Joshua Johnson. And last week, a heat wave hit the Pacific Northwest with temperatures consistently in the triple digits. Meanwhile, millions in Europe are battling a heat wave that they're calling Lucifer. And late last night, it was reported that a climate change report drafted by 13 federal agencies has made its way to the White House. And this report concludes that human activity is responsible for the drastic rise in global temperatures in the past few decades. For the rest of this hour, we're going to be talking about keeping cool as temperatures go up. But first, energy reporter Steve Mufson of The Washington Post is going to join us to help make sense of this report I just referred to. Steve, welcome to 1A. Steve Mufson, are you out there? All right, we're going to make an effort to bring Steve in. In the meantime, we're going to move on to a broader discussion about the impacts of air conditioning, and I want to welcome three more guests to the show. First, let's bring in Durward Zelke. He is president of the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development. Durward, welcome to 1A.
Thank you.
And joining us via Skype in Marin County, California, is Stephen Johnson, author of How We Got to Now, Six Innovations That Made the Modern World. Hi, Stephen.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, thanks. And also joining us from the studios of KMUW in Wichita, Kansas, Stan Cox, lead scientist of the Land Institute and author of Losing Our Cool, Uncomfortable Truths About Our Air-Conditioned World. Welcome, Stan.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
It's good to have you as well. Durward, let's start with you. And the report, if Steve joins us, we can flesh it out a little bit more. But the report basically was put together by, over the last year, part of an annual four-year report made on the request of Congress, a national climate assessment. And it reports absolute consistency among the agencies that global warming is increasing. It's predicting outcomes such as a half-point degree over the next 50 years, rise in temperatures, which it says will have significant effects. So and in the political sense, this is also running countering to the narratives and the convictions of many in the Trump administration, including the head of the Environmental Protection Agency. So there's likely going to be some sort of political collision over this report if and when it is actually formally made public. What we're talking about is a leak right now. But what we wanted to focus on was the part of the story that involves all of us who at this moment might be sitting in an atmosphere where the temperature hovers around 71 or 72 degrees. You and I are doing that in the studio. I think people in their cars are probably around that temperature. You've just pointed out that you're wearing a jacket, so you're so cold, and people in their homes. It's all of us have become accustomed to climate control. And the question is, at what cost to the environment?
Well, there are two things that we need to pay attention to with air conditioning. The first one is the refrigerant that is used to produce the cooling. And the dominant refrigerant has been fluorinated gas, starting with CFCs, we used to call Freon by their trade name, and they were destroying the stratospheric ozone layer and causing tremendous warming to the climate. Then we moved to chemicals called HCFCs, and now we're moving into HFCs. These chemicals have got to be taken out of the system. HFCs are the current one that we're focusing on through the Montreal Protocol. This is the best treaty that the world has ever created to protect the climate. It has solved the first great threat to the global atmosphere of stratospheric ozone depletion and has done more to protect the climate than any other treaty, having solved an amount of climate impact that would otherwise be equal to the impact from carbon dioxide, the main greenhouse gas. So that's one piece. Got to make sure those refrigerants are taken out of the system and that we move to climate-friendly refrigerants, which we have.
We do.
And the parties have, to the Montreal Protocol, agreed last October to amend their treaty to get rid of HFCs. That's one of the six main greenhouse gases. We're kicking them out of the universe. And because of that, we'll be able to avoid about a half a degree Celsius of warming in the future and avoid about 100 billion tons of CO2 equivalent. That's a very, very large number.
Let me stop you there.
Okay.
And at the point of you're mentioning that half degree Celsius, because a half degrees figure in that report I was just talking about, and Steve Mufson from The Washington Post is now able to join us. Steve, welcome to 1A.
Glad to be here.
So the background on this report, I'm assuming it represents a leak, and so gets a little bit of jazz from that fact itself. But what about the content of the report? Who wrote it to begin with?
Well, it's scientists from 13 different federal agencies, and it's called the Climate Science Special Report. It's a very important component in drawing up the National Climate Assessment, which is an even more important report that's supposed to guide government activity. Although in this case, as I think you've said before, that the report seems very much out of step with what the Trump administration has been saying.
So what's its future in that case, do you assume?
Well, I think its future is being seen as a test of the Trump administration's attitude towards science in general and climate science in particular. This isn't entirely unprecedented. Under George W. Bush, there was a lot of delay and editing by people who had previously worked in the oil industry. These climate assessments are supposed to come out every 4 years under a law passed in 1990, but we've only had three of them published. So it's been a difficult politicized process for a long time, but I think maybe now more than ever.
And the fact that it got leaked indicates what to you?
It indicates that there are people who have been involved in writing the report who want to have this draft out there as a benchmark mm-hmm. in case it's heavily edited, and then people will be able to see what changes the White House has made.
And there has been, just to the leaks itself in your paper in the New York Times, have there been any reaction from the White House?
No, there's no reaction from the White House. There's not a particular deadline they need to meet. They've got a lot of things on their minds. There's an office in the White House that would ordinarily be the central coordinator on that report, but no one's in that job at the moment. So that's also a factor in this. It's just they're a little thin in some of these areas, yeah. And it's hard to say when people will be appointed to those jobs and what kind of people.
And I took a stab at summarizing its findings, but bottom line, can you take a stab at it? Bottom line, what does this report tell us?
Well, I think the most important thing is that it says in more strenuous terms than before that climate change is linked to human activity and human emissions, not only that you can start to quantify this and say that well over half of the increase in global warming since 1951 is attributable to human activity, and that the human activity that we've already taken has put us on a path toward greater climate change in the decades to come.
All right.
So it's a little bit more specific about linking climate change to human activity.
Okay, Steve, that helps set us up very, very well. Thanks so much, Steve Mufflin, energy reporter for The Washington Post, for joining with us.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
So, Derwood, you were talking about the fact that we can... The part of it that Steve was just talking about, the human contribution, mm-hmm. and we're focusing today on the part that all of us have a role in by that switch we can turn on or off in our house or open a window or not. You're saying that there are ways to operate air conditioning, to build it so that it is less environmentally harmful.
Absolutely. So the first thing, as I said, was to change your refrigerant, which we've done, gives us a huge amount of climate protection for the future. The second thing, while we're phasing out this bad refrigerant, we need to drastically improve the energy efficiency of air conditioning. We're going to add at least 900 million new air conditioners by 2030 in the warming world, probably a lot more than that. And we need to make sure that they are super efficient. People do need cooling, they do need comfort, but they don't need to steal the energy from other uses. So if we make the air conditioners of the future super efficient, we can avoid building at least 100 medium-sized peak power plants every year between now and 2030. 50.
What I find interesting is you're saying that the need for some form of air conditioning will be increasing down the road because the world will be warming up, which takes it to an interesting place. And that wasn't the case, as far as we know, 40 or 50 or 60 years ago when Americans began to become addicted to air conditioning. And for that part of the conversation, I want to bring in Stephen Johnson, who is the author, I said before, of How We Got to Now, Six Innovations That Made the Modern World. Steve, catch us up on, you actually make the case that there's great social change came about because of air conditioning. And we can imagine some of it, but you take it to some interesting places, including your argument that air conditioning helped to influence a U.S. election. Stephen, I just want to make sure that you're hearing me. Okay, you're not. So the show with gremlins today. Let me bring in then Stan Cox. You wrote the book, Losing Our Cool and Comfortable Truths About Our Air-Conditioned World. I mentioned before just now with Durwood this notion that as the climate is getting warmer, the need for air conditioning will go up. But you also have an argument about just the way that we live and build creates a negative feedback loop. Talk a little bit about how the cycle of air conditioning creates the need for more air conditioning.
Yes. Air conditioning is being brought up more and more as a climate adaptation strategy. But it's that kind of strategy in which the solution is increasing and will continue to indefinitely to increase the amount of greenhouse gases going into the atmosphere is a self-defeating one. Air conditioning is an excellent example of that century-old quip that invention is the mother of necessity. Once we built this country without air conditioning, then once it became available and cheap enough to use, we began building our designing our buildings, our transportation system, everything to be dependent on air conditioning, so that now we have painted ourselves into a corner that's not going to be easy to get out of.
Well, talk to me about, let's take architecture as an example, our buildings. How do the buildings we live in today reflect the fact that air conditioning exists?
In the 50s and 60s, contractors realized that central air conditioning had become cheap enough that they could build, use much cheaper construction, doing away with high ceilings, large eaves, large porches, basements, cross-ventilated designs, and could build basically cubes or boxes that depended on air conditioning to be habitable, and they could actually be cheaper than the old way, and that has continued, and also eventually putting entire glass sides on the south and west side of buildings.
I mean, yeah, I noticed just in terms of, I assume you're talking about the fact that eaves and balconies and high ceilings were once part of construction because there needed to be a more sort of natural circulation and cooling effect in before air conditioning. And now, you know, you can't, it's very hard to go find an office building where you can, or a hotel room, where you can actually open the window. The assumption is that fresh air will never cross your path, that it all has to come through circulation. And so I think that gets to the point of how architecturally we've committed ourselves to a system where we need central air conditioning or we're going to suffocate. I want to share some emails that were, and we're getting quite a bit in tweets as well. This one comes from Jenny, who says, I grew up in Smithfield, North Carolina, on the coastal plain, a hot and humid small town with temperatures often over 100 degrees. As children, we fried eggs on the sidewalk for fun. Fast forward to our setting in the mountains of North Carolina. We did not install air conditioning when we built our house here. Now, again, she's talking about the mountains, cooler place. Global warming has changed the summers and winters, though. It's seldom cold enough to use the powerful wood-burning furnace we installed. Every summer, we revisit our no air conditioning decision. But so far, we're sticking to the open windows and the fresh air that we value. And Sarah writes in, I would love to run our air conditioning less, but I live in a suburban neighborhood where backyard fire pits have become a stupid fad. That's her word, not mine. Now, I routinely get smoked out of my home on beautiful summer evenings if I try to open my windows. It's ridiculous. And from Vera, she writes, when I worked in an office in D.C., the women used to bring heavy jackets in the summer so they could stand the air conditioning. It's pleasant to have AC. What I find wasteful is to have it at Arctic temperatures. When I walk from the outside to a gelid environment, my tendency is to go back out from the temperature shock. That's the first time I've seen that word in a tweet. We Americans are too dependent on chilly rooms to refresh our bodies, but the cost of these benefits on the environment are tremendous. Do we really need to have the thermostat in the low 60s? And now Stephen Johnson has rejoined us. And Stephen, you've looked back at a number of technologies and innovations that you say have changed our lives in ways that nobody would have anticipated, including the idea that in the summer we could live in a room that's in the 60s, as Vera was just pointing out. But what I want to get back to this question I asked you before when you dropped off. How did air conditioning influence a U.S. election? Oh, and you know what? Yeah, well, you have 1 minute to tell this story.
Okay. Well, what ends up happening is with the introduction of air conditioning and home air conditioning units right around 1950, almost immediately there is this massive migration, one of the largest migrations in the history of the United States, to the Sun Belt states, to Florida. Tucson went from 45,000 people to 200,000 people in 10 years. Houston almost doubled in that same amount of time. Florida went from half a million people to 10 million people over the course of about 40 years. And air conditioning really just made those places, you know, livable in a way that they weren't before. And that led to a swing in the Electoral College, where you had a major swing towards the Sun Belt states. And because a lot of those people were older, more conservative retirees, that changed the political complexion. And that Sun Belt conservative coalition was absolutely central to Ronald Reagan's successful bid for the presidency in 1980. I mean, it is possible that Reagan would have been elected had air conditioning not been invented, but it is empirically true he would have needed a different kind of political strategy in the Electoral College had that change not happened.
Fascinating analysis, and we'll have more of it coming up after the break when we talk about air conditioning on a global scale. What's going to happen when air conditioning becomes more popular in developing nations? We'll be back in just a minute, so stay close. This is John Donvan, and this is 1A. I'm in for Joshua Johnson today. And a quick word about our program tomorrow. We have a very simple question to ask you. Why are we so lousy at taking vacation? You know we are, but we would love to hear your stories about why we are so bad at taking time off. So leave us a voicemail with your stories about that at 855-236-1A1A and press option 2. Again, we just want to know, why do you think we're so bad at taking time off? Tell us your story, 855-236-1A1A and press option 2. So it is August and heat waves are sweeping over the globe, and we're talking about air conditioning with Derwood Zelke. He is president of the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development. Stephen Johnson, author of How We Got to Now, and Stan Cox, lead scientist of the Land Institute and author of Losing Our Cool. And I want to share with you a voicemail left to us with us by a listener on this topic.
This is Shara Whitmer, and I'm calling from Mountain Green, Utah. And my husband and I, we are planning a trip to live on a sailboat for a year. And we won't be leaving for a few months, but I decided to start living kind of that simple life. And part of that was to see if I could use my air conditioning less in my home. And going one hot summer day without the air conditioning all day was very difficult, and I found myself being a little ornery and uncomfortable, but now I'm able to go a whole week and not turn the air on. And I just imagine that I'm someplace warm and tropical, and I enjoy the heat now. And so it only took a few days to become comfortable with the uncomfortable, and it's been great.
All right, that's Cher Whitmore. Thanks for that message, Cher. But I wanna share a tweet from someone named Scott, who says, in one sentence, you can have my air conditioning when you pry it from my cold, dead hand. I like cold in that sentence. Derwood, we are talking to some degree here about personal decision-making. Not entirely, but to some degree. The idea that we may just have to get over being spoiled by chilly air and suck it up and be a little bit hotter. Is that a hard sell? First of all, is that a necessary sell? Is that a message that people should accept?
Well, I think people need to understand that they can condition themselves to being chilled, and that makes it more difficult to go back out into a warm climate. You need to use air conditioning judiciously and make sure you don't get so addicted that you can't go outside. So I like the comment from the woman on preparation for her sailing trip. I mean, you can, again, you can hurt your broader adaptability. So we don't want to do that. I think we have the opportunity not only to use air conditioning judiciously, but to buy the kind that is smart enough to go on and cool just the space that we're in when we're in it, to turn off when we're not there, to follow us around a room. This is a computer chip that goes in the machine that costs about $2.50 for the smart brain.
I had no idea. That's there already?
This is coming onto the market, and it also can link to the utility when the demand on the grid gets too much because everybody turns up their air conditioning when it gets hot. The utility can manage that by turning your thermostat up a few degrees. So we have some technological opportunities, but we also have the design that Stan was mentioning, and we need to pay very close attention to that. I grew up in Palm Springs for several of my young years. We always had a white roof on every house there, mm-hmm. reflecting about 50 degrees Fahrenheit of heat back into space. So, again, we can cut down the demand. You made the point about the developing world. This is our real challenge. So in India, for example, a country of about 1.2 billion people and growing pretty fast, the penetration of air conditioning is only about 7% of the urban population. And yet, with that less than 10%, they're using at least half of their electricity for air conditioning. So when it gets hot, the rich, who are the less than 10% who own the air conditioning, turn up their machines, and it often blows out the grid, which means no one has any electricity whatsoever. So what is India going to do as the population gets richer and demands more air conditioning? This is happening. It happened in China. In about 15 years, urban China, went from almost no air conditioners to 140% penetration, meaning 40% of the people have more than one. Mm-hmm. If India follows that same trajectory, they cannot possibly have the energy they need for their other development opportunities. So efficiency becomes central for countries like India, Indonesia, the Philippines, I mean, indeed, all the world.
Stephen, after you discovered this political dimension to air conditioning and possibly attributing Ronald Reagan's successful win to the existence of air conditioning as one dimension of the process, what dimensions do you dream to the future? For example, as Derwood was just talking, the rest of the world is unquestionably aspiring to be cool, to be cooled off, of course, to be cool as well. But what consequences do you foresee along the same lines of the kinds of dimensions you brought to the analysis of the Reagan win?
Well, I think the first thing that's worth pointing out is actually just looking back that we have been tinkering technologically with making things cold for a remarkably short amount of time, right? Making things warm, in a sense, is like the original technological innovation, the mastery of fire, right? So that's an ancient story. And we've built, elaborate machines to create explosions and generate heat over a long technological history, but really air conditioning has only been around in any form for about 120 years. And by the way, I think this is another thing I love about the history of it is when Willis Carrier invents air conditioning in 1902 in Brooklyn, he's working for a printing press in Brooklyn, and he'd been assigned basically to invent a machine just to dehumidify the printing press because they were having trouble with the ink running on the page. And so he invents this machine that takes moisture out of the air, but it also makes the air cooler, really as a kind of an afterthought. And all of a sudden, everybody at the printing press is like, hey, I want to have lunch in the room with that machine. It's really nice in there. And so we start to develop this taste. But we've only been really, you know, dealing with this for 120 years. And in terms of home AC, it's only been 70. But I think
I just to jump in on the home AC part, my mom, who came of age just before and during World War II, would tell me that in the evenings they would go to the movies, not because of the movie, but because that was one of the few public places that was air conditioned. And she lived in the Bronx in New York City, and nobody had air conditioning. And New York can get pretty hot. But for her, the breakthrough to actually having the thing in her home, which happened in the late 50s, I'm guessing, was like a dramatic shift from everything she'd known before, which was basically, she would say they would literally sleep outside in the Bronx in the evenings to stay cooler on the rooftops of their buildings. So this jump you're talking about from nowhere to being in public places to being in homes is recent and dramatic.
Well, and there's another funny side effect of this, which is that AC really made the idea of a summer movie blockbuster possible.
Oh, really?
Because until... you're right. AC was first introduced into movie theaters. That was one of the first places where ordinary people would experience it. Some office buildings, but movie theaters. And so, before that, you know, a crowded movie theater on a 100-degree day would be the last place you would want to go. You know, wouldn't want to sit around with like 2,000 people in a big room on a hot day indoors. But once you had AC, suddenly it was like, oh, this is a great time to go to the movies. And so then people started organizing the kind of calendar of movie releases around summer because that was the time everyone wanted to be in a cool air-conditioned theater. So there are all these consequences, but what it means going forward, it's really... Part of the problem with these things is it's hard to predict. I mean, you know, one big question obviously that a lot of us are thinking about is to what extent will people be able to, you know, precisely in some of these Sunbelt states that do have a lot of solar energy available to them, are they going to be able to power these devices through solar? And if we can get them more efficient, if we can get the internal kind of chemistry right, there may be a way for people to continue advancing the technology and continue staying cool in these hot environments without the environmental impact.
And Stan, one of our producers today was talking about an image she saw related to a heat spike led to images of more and more coal being delivered to a power plant because they needed to get the air in the homes cooler, which meant they had to burn more coal in a hurry. Is that sort of inevitable? And until we get to some sort of, you know, nirvana of solar-powered air conditioning, does air conditioning always mean more burning of fossil fuels?
Yes, and it will continue for decades to mean that. Right now, the total quantity of electricity being produced from renewable sources is more or less equivalent to the amount of electricity being consumed by air conditioning. And the increases that are projected by the government, by 2040, air conditioning will still be accounting for almost 40% of the renewable generation. And so that's 40% of renewable generation not available for anything else. It's going to, we need to begin cutting fossil fuel use and carbon emissions immediately based on the most recent research if we're going to avoid runaway warming. And it's got to be done before we are able to replace all of our power infrastructure with renewables, which means we've got to start using less energy now, not in 2050 or 2100.
I'm going to go to some more tweets. I'm very interested in these people talking about the recent past. Paula tweets, I grew up in Houston, Texas. Office jobs used to include hardship pay. until air conditioning. That's one I hadn't heard. And somebody calling himself Kokomo Kid tweets, I'm in my Florida condo, very comfortable, 80 degrees right now. Remove excess clothes and turn up the temp. So there's a kid, Kokomo Kid, who's saying he's making his own adaptation to it. And in a tweet from a different direction, somebody named Gato, I'm a commercial air conditioner tech. These rooftop units are way inefficient and leaky. More efficient units are way expensive, especially for residential. So that brings it back to Durwood. You're talking about the technologies. Is the stuff that's efficient, are the units that are efficient really, really expensive at this point?
Well, if you look at the global market, there are some on the market that are being made that are very efficient and not much more expensive. What you really need to look at, though, is the life cycle, climate performance, and cost. So the payback period for a more expensive and much more efficient air conditioner is about 2 years, maybe 2.5 years. Every time you use it after that period, you are saving money. So that's an average of a 10-year life. So you're taking money to the bank if you make the investment in a more efficient machine up front. And what we haven't talked about is the top floor deaths. You know, the people who are in old buildings without air conditioners who die around the world in heat waves, which we're going to have more and more until we get climate change under control. So where does air conditioning and the right to cooling and comfort become essentially a human right? So we're in a squeeze where we are clearly using more fossil fuel to produce the cooling. The cooling is then contributing to more warming. This is a form of cannibalism where the initial warming feeds upon itself, and then the air conditioning adds to this. And yet we need this cooling. So I think we're going to be in a position where technology and the efficiency that is already on the market has to be brought to scale for everyone in India, China, throughout the world.
Stephen Johnson, Durwood's comment about air conditioning crossing over into a human right, it's the first time I've heard that formulation. Have you heard that before?
No, it's very interesting. I hadn't thought about it in quite that way, but I think that could... I could see that becoming increasingly the case.
And that's, Durwood, you're talking about that because it's about health, ultimately.
Well, I mean, we've been talking a lot about productivity in the South and the Southwest and Florida and so on, and that's very important. I mean, the former Prime Minister of Singapore, Lee Kuan Yew, said that, you know, the most important invention of the 20th century was the air conditioner because it allowed people to be productive in Singapore and the rest of the world. So... But health is at least as important. And remember, it's a warming world, and you need to keep your windows closed because of smoke that the one person mentioned, but also because mosquitoes are carrying Zika and other viruses. And so we have to pay attention to how important it is.
We have a tweet from Naomi who asks, can you touch on the health issues related to constant air conditioning and closed air systems? So I think that question's going the other way. Does being in an air-conditioned space cause harm to your health?
Well, if you live in Italy, apparently you think that it does. I mean, the New York Times reported this yesterday in a story about air conditioning, that while Lucifer is causing people around Europe to turn up their air conditioning to stay cool, in Italy, the physicians and the citizens think that air conditioning can cause more health problems. So I had not heard that before. I mean, clearly, you know, you can get a chill if you're down in the mid-60s of your temperature. But if you manage it properly, I have not heard. And you keep your system clean. Clean your filters. That makes you more efficient and keeps the pathogens out as well.
I've seen some studies done out of the UK suggesting that because the rise of air conditioning is relatively coterminous with the obesity epidemic, that they're looking at a link. No evidence of that so far, but one of the studies suggests that coolness has an impact on appetite, one way or the other, and that part's in dispute. But so far, nothing on that?
Well, it probably makes you drink less alcohol. So let's look at the upside there.
All right. Well, we've been speaking with Stan Cox, the lead scientist of the Land Institute and author of Losing Our Cool, Uncomfortable Truths About Our Air-Conditioned World. Stan, thanks so much for joining us today. And Stephen Johnson, author of How We Got to Now, Six Innovations That Made the World. Thanks, Stephen.
My pleasure.
And David Zelke, he's president of the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development. Thanks so much, Derwood, for joining us.
Thank you.
Remember to send us your stories about this topic and also our upcoming topic tomorrow on why it is that Americans have such a hard time taking vacation. You can reach us at 855-236-1A1A. Or email us 1A@WAMU.org. 1A comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm John Donvan, in for Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.